Mike Oldak from Edison Electric Institute. Mike is the Senior Director for State Competitive and Regulatory Policies. He'll be giving us a little general information about DSR and energy efficiency, but he will then be focusing on electric revenue decoupling. And he'll conclude by 11:30, and then we're going to call the California PUC, and they're going to have a few people lined up to talk to us. So we'll just kind of keep moving once Mike is finished. Okay? Go ahead.
Thank you. I always used to tell jokes in my speeches about California and Illinois. I can't anymore. I live in Maryland. it's crazy. But number one, I think what's important about decoupling, and I'll get there, is the fact that you really need to really focus back on the regulatory compact, what this industry is all about. Hope and Bluefield, a balance of consumer and utility interests, investments that are dedicated to the public interest. We're basically entitled to a return of that investment and a return on that investment commensurate with the risk. That's basically the bargain. And if you keep that in mind and when you're thinking about decoupling, I think it really helps understand where people are going, where the industry is going. But number one, are we in an energy crisis? And we poll our members and we poll their customers, and basically 61% of the customers we poll say yes, that we are in an energy crisis. And when you come into Maryland and you're understanding that regulation is a lot more right now about politics than economics and finance, you understand that when consumers believe there's an energy crisis, maybe there is one, number one, and we have to respond to that. But I think that they are absolutely right. We are in an energy crisis. That we have lots of parts of the country where the generation margins are shrinking, and we need to build infrastructure in this country, a lot of that infrastructure. There's concerns over supply of gas, pricing of natural gas, quality of natural gas, coal transportation from the Powder River Basin, greater scrutiny on the competitive wholesale markets and the market players. We now have mandatory enforceable reliability laws, and if you follow the trade press, a few of my members have recently found the sharp end of that stick. And more reliance on renewables, demand-side management, energy efficiency, and let me tell you, this is where the industry is going. We are in a partnership with NARUC right now, and we are pushing very hard on energy efficiency. We have basically five programs, one on smart appliances, one on smart homes, one on advanced metering infrastructure, one on innovative rates and regulation, and one on plug-in hybrid vehicles. So these are five key areas that EEI is going forward on. But we're seeing that in both the restructured and the unrestructured states, rates are going up. When we started, the restructured states were about 35% higher than the unrestructured states. And I think a lot of the restructuring started because they thought competition would bring those rates down, and they needed to do something for economic development. But what we've seen is that for a lot of reasons that the rate increases in both the restructured and unrestructured states have been about the same. But I think this is the most important chart that we have. And if you take a look at the area we're here, reliability first, in 2008, NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Council, says that we will be below minimum reliability requirements for reserve margin. That's important because we found in California, when you look back, when they went down to 7% reserve margins, supply and demand get way out of whack and the wholesale market prices go through the roof. And that's when customers get upset, that's when politicians get upset, and that's when the politicians start to help us. But the perfect storm, number one, we've got to keep energy and supply in balance. That's the number one criteria. And we're projected doubling the use of energy by 2030. We still are doing a great job on energy conservation efficiency, but we still are. I mean, how many people out have gone and bought a new plasma TV? They're out there. But those are they use five times the amount of energy of an old TV. And computers, iPods, all of the uses for electric. We're providing energy security and availability, the political realities that we are in on oil and natural gas and foreign reliance on fuels, that's entering into the mix. And we need to harmonize the use of energy with the environment. And I think with the Democrats taking over the House and the Senate, we're going to, as you know, see a lot more emphasis on the environment coming forward. But the key question is, can we develop the right mix of supply and demand options so that we can keep everything in balance? Let's talk quickly about what's driving our prices. And you can see from this chart, this basically shows the generation that was produced based on public policy. And as you probably all know, in the last 10 years or so, we've built nothing but natural gas. And during that period, natural gas prices have gone up 400%. Well, do the math. And this is in the regulated and the restructured and the unrestructured states. So everyone is feeling the pinch of natural gas prices. We need over $300 billion of investment in generation to meet the future needs. That's a lot of money. Question is climate change? Are we seeing global warming really happening? And we did a survey, and let me tell you, 72% of consumers say yes, and that will drive the Congress. And so what we see is translating that into dollars and investment by utilities. We're looking at about $85 billion on environmental retrofits and cleaning up existing plants, and that's money that consumers are going to have to pay. We need renewables. We're seeing there's a proposal I was reading this morning. I think it's 25% of the United States energy from renewables by 2025. That's a proposal going forward in Congress. I've seen a lot of states do 20 in 2020 or something like that, but there's a great pressure to move toward renewables, and that's going to add to the price of electricity. Arizona Public Service, one of my members in Arizona, has a cost-based solar tariff. If you'd like solar power in Arizona, the Sunshine State, it is now down to 25 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's sort of the economics, what we're seeing compared to what we see normally, about 7 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour here. Transmission. We need about $30 billion of new transmission to beef up the transmission grid that's aging and to move generation from places where it's being built to places where it needs. On distribution, we're looking at about $13 billion a year over the next 10 years. And rate caps are coming off. And let me tell you, you all know what the rate increase was in Maryland. It went up 72%. But it shouldn't be a surprise for anybody. The restructuring was started in 1999. In 1999, they took the rate and they dropped it back to 1993 rates. And so you went from 1993 rates to 2006 costs. And this was 4 months after Katrina wiped out a quarter of the gas production in the country, and that's what drove it from a 72% increase. And so now we're starting to question, is it a good idea to have these long-term rate freezes where at the end of it you're going to have a huge spike that consumers and politicians are going to get upset about, or do you want to have more of a glide path and a slow transition toward the upper rates? And this is what happens. So what else is affecting rates? Critical infrastructure protection, disaster recovery, Florida power, FPL went through 4 of the 5 hurricanes a few years ago. $900 million of restoration. That is their full net earnings for a year wiped out. We've got regional transmission organizations that are helping to form these wholesale markets, and they're working, but they are expensive to form and operate. Pension funds and health care costs going up, disaster recovery. So the bottom line is that there are a lot of costs going up, regardless of everything else that we're trying to do. So which way do we wander? Where should the industry be going? How do we keep supply and demand in balance? How do we prevent all these costs from killing customers and providing price spikes that take the authority out of the PUC and put it into the legislature, where you're going to see legislation that's going to control how things are done rather than the Public Utility Commission? energy efficiency is one way that we see. And you can see back here in the 70s, we had probably looked like a 3-4% growth. Here's a 1% growth, and we're seeing basically below 1% growth for the investor-owned utilities in the country, and that's actually going down, has gone down since the crisis in 2000. This is interesting. This is California, and I think this is really important. California had almost a flat load growth, and then they started picking up in the late 90s, and then the crisis hit, and you can see they dropped from about 6,000 kilowatt hours down to about 4,000, a drop of a third, and this was tremendous rate design pressure. This was PSA announcements, you know, stop using electricity, and everybody seeing prices that went through the roof. Everybody knew about it, and I think that drove everybody to really be critical of how they used electricity, and they stopped, and they used a third less on average. But 2 years later, look where they are. They're back up. And this tells you something about elasticity. This tells you something about if you're relying on customers to do it rather than smart meters and smart devices, it could be short term. And so a lot of the energy efficiency we're looking to build into smart homes, smart appliances. So the customer comes in and they'll plug in their new refrigerator, and all of a sudden the smart meter realizes that there's a new refrigerator. It talks to the refrigerator. It can control the refrigerator, and the customers have to do nothing. But they can save money on electricity, and we can keep supply and demand in balance. This is what we're looking forward to. And we talk about AMI. I look at this as the electric utility industry meets the internet. When the internet started, remember, we didn't know what we were going to do with it. Now it controls our lives, basically. And I think that AMI and the ability to have two-way communication with customers, with devices, something that EPRI talks about, prices to devices, which basically control their usage, that's where we're going, and that's why AMI is really so important. You can see our spending in demand side management expenditures and the energy savings. I think this roughly equates to about 68 million homes that we are providing electricity with we're using the conservation efficiency measures. And we're seeing at the federal level appliance standards, new equipment standards, commercial, residential, federal tax incentives, and for manufacturing tax credits to create new devices and appliances that are energy savings. They're getting tax credits also. So we're going to see appliances have a lower cost to consumers and make them more available because of what the federal government's doing. Now, where does this leave utilities? I think we are in a unique situation, a unique position to help consumers. We basically understand the economy's scope and scale, and when we control air conditioners, water heaters, we can, you know, move this around on our system and basically try to provide lower costs for everyone and keep supply and demand in balance. We have a knowledge of their loads and their processes and the rates and everything. So we really are in a good position. But there are challenges. And there are options. There are ways of doing this. And decoupling that I'm going to talk about is one way. But really there's rate structure reform. And I think a lot of people probably have tried it, and we've talked about it for a long time. You talk to an economist, and they say fixed costs are fixed costs, variable costs are variable costs. Charge everyone the fixed cost for the pole, the transformer, the wire to get it to their house, and then charge them the variable cost for the energy so that every customer would get a $30, $40, $50 bill every month just for having the service available, sort of like cable. And then if you wanted electricity, you paid on a kilowatt-hour basis. So that would make it so that the utilities really didn't care how much you used. You used more, you paid more. You used less, you paid less. It didn't matter for us. We make very little, if anything, on the throughput under that mechanism, so we wouldn't have any incentives or disincentives. But what we found is that a lot of people don't want to see a $50 minimum bill each month, like your cable bill. They want a per kilowatt-hour basis. So the senator who has a hunting lodge out in the mountains and uses it 2 months or 2 weekends a month for 3 months will pay, you know, $7 for those few weekends and nothing during the rest of the year. That's really what we're looking at. So there is a rate design solution, but I don't think we've tried this for a long time. We haven't been able to get to that solution. There's broad decoupling and true-up mechanisms that really are designed to take the disincentive out of energy and conservation. We are in an industry and with rate design that when people conserve and we push programs where people use less, utilities are hurt financially because a kilowatt hour is not just energy, it recovers fixed costs. And that's what decoupling does. It removes that disincentive for us to do these kinds of programs. And there's contract demand. There's lots of different options on keeping utilities whole. So where does it leave utilities? It really depends on how the rates were designed in the first place. Does the rate design that the utility is subject to require full throughput and basically meeting sales expectation to get the amount of money that was authorized and approved by the commission to recover? Is it dependent on us selling up to that limit? And therefore, if we sell less and do energy efficiency conservation and sell lower, are we hurt? Is there financial flexibility to maintain the system and meet load growth? And I think this is important. Yes, people say, you know, a lot of NARUC and people say we want to have decoupling because, you know, the more utilities sell, the more money they make. And so this is incentive to sell more. And from a state commission prospect, you know, this is true. If it's on a kilowatt hour basis and depending on how you set up the rate, the more you sell at some point you're going to make more, but to a certain extent that float, it really is a float, provides for capital expansion, emergencies, maintenance, higher pension funds. It's sort of a float that the utility can have and prevent them or keep them from having to go in for another rate case. The bottom line is we're always entitled to go in for another rate case. If you want us to come in every year like some of my members do and have a rate case, then this is less important. If you want to have adjustment clauses that basically put us where we should have been and where we were entitled to earn the authorized return that the commission approved, then you need some kind of true-up. I see a no, but... Okay. What we've seen is, in some cases, for a wires-only company, having reduction in throughput, even at a 10% level, can lead to bankruptcy. It really depends on the rate design and how it's done. But that's why some kind of true-up mechanism is important. There are many basic techniques to doing decoupling. Basically, there's just a standard throughput adjustment, so that if your throughput goes down and you are short on this amount of contribution to the fixed costs or don't meet the authorized revenue requirement, that goes in sort of like an automatic adjustment clause, and the next rate case rates go up a little bit to pay for that. If you sell more than estimated and you make too much money, then that goes to lower the rates next time. It's an automatic adjustment clause to put the utility where they were authorized to be. It provides revenue surety, a consistent collection of costs between rate cases. And let me tell you, when Wall Street looks at my members, and we are going in for over $500 billion of new investment, the clear path to recovery of and on their investment determines how much they charge us for that capital. And when we can have a clear path and a stability of rates and revenues, the cost of capital goes down. And that's a cost that really gets fed through to consumers. If you want to have rate volatility, we've seen the cost of capital go up, and at the end of the day, consumers pay for it one way or the other. NRRI polled some of the state commissioners and said that decoupling stabilizes the utility's financial position. It lowered the cost of capital, provided low-cost protection against reduced profitability. They also did a study in 1994 saying that it breaks the linkage between sales, revenues, and profits by precluding utility from retaining any revenues that exceeded the revenue requirement. The utility has no incentive to pursue additional sales. It keeps the utility whole, and it puts demand-side management energy efficiency on a more equal footing with supply-side investment. So the utility should be neutral to a certain extent on whether they want to build new generation or do demand response energy efficiency. How does it work? As I said, basically, traditional, you establish a base year and you figure out basically The first year rates are the authorized revenues divided by the projected annual energy sales. Simple formula: how much money are we entitled to collect, what was approved by the commission, divided by what the commission believes will be our estimated sales. And that gives you basically a dollar per kilowatt hour charge. And then each year's actual revenues are compared with the calculated needs. And there's a balancing or true up that occurs. For example, regulators establish a forecast of 100 kWh and determine the authorized revenue requirement. They've got $6 worth of fixed costs for production. The variable cost is 4 cents a kilowatt hour. If we were going to use 100 kW, basically it comes out to $10. And the $10 divided by 100 kW gives you 10 cents per kilowatt hour. That's the rate. So let's take a look at what happens. We're successful. And instead of selling 100 kWh, we sell 95. You put it through the formula, and basically we lost 30 cents in this example because we didn't meet the sales estimates to meet our full requirements. On the other side, if we sold more, 105, the converse, the utility over-collects. So basically what the automatic adjustment, the decoupling would do is have an adjustment to the next year's revenues to recover that 30 cents or pay it back to consumers and basically leave the utility where the commission had set it. PG&E is, and the California Commission is actually doing a lot of good work on this, and I'm glad that they're going to follow and can really explain this. I stole all these slides from one of my friends from PG&E, so these are his slides, and I think I understand what he was saying. They basically have an ERAM, Electric Revenue Adjustment Mechanism, for non-fuel costs. They had an energy cost adjustment for the fuel and fuel-related costs, and then they had an attrition rate adjustment, which they said was really important, that you had to have an attrition adjustment along with the ERAM in order for it to function successfully. And this basically allowed the utility to earn an authorized return in the attrition years. It recovered costs from customer growth, inflation, aging facility replacement, all of those other items, basically keeping everything in line. Basically, what they do to prepare for the case, the costs are segregated by type, fuel versus non-fuel. Target revenues are set and authorized by the regulators. And basically, they follow through the basic mechanisms we've talked about. After the restructuring, or during the restructuring, let me just check what time it is. The rates were frozen. There was a transition revenue requirement that replaced the ERAM. And basically, with the skyrocketing costs, you know, the utilities went bankrupt. They basically, after restructuring, after the bankruptcies, replaced the ERAM and basically did the same thing that they did before, but they segregated the costs further. There's an energy resource cost adjustment for fuel and fuel-related, electric distribution cost adjustment, retained utility generation costs, public purpose programs, nuclear decommissioning costs, and basically a lot of automatic adjustment clauses to keep the utility's revenue where it was authorized and bring them back to financial viability. They basically put this into the California law and said that the commission shall ensure that errors in estimates of demand elasticity or sales not result in material over or under collections. So that is now the California law. They have made decoupling basically mandated in California. And I hate to use the word decoupling because it has so many different meanings. This is a very sophisticated, very broad decoupling. It has a lot of components. It's different than the revenues going up and down. It allows for indexing. It allows for, you know, providing more than just a revenue change. It looks at CapEx expenditures. If you're making those expenditures, it looks at the changing interest rates up or down. So it really does keep the utility needs in line with commission authorized rates. San Diego did the same thing, but a little differently. They're basically using an index mechanism, and that they share revenues that exceed the authorized rate of return, 50%, by if it exceeds authorized by 50 basis points, they share it with consumers. If it goes up or down by 175 basic points, anyone can file to suspend it. If it goes up or down by 300, it is automatically suspended, and they go back in for a rate case. Lawrence Berkeley Labs, looking at California, said it has had negligible effect on rate levels, reduced rate volatility, and only a small portion of the total change in revenue requirements was due to clearing of these balances. So there was a small amount based on how they were doing it. Other states have rejected decoupling, and I think this is important to look at these, for example, of how to do it right and how to do it wrong. New York rejected it at one point because of the negative impact on rate stability. The bottom line is if you wait a year, 2 years, or a long period of time and you have a lot of costs going forward, you still will go up or down by a lot of amount. These balances can be large. PEPCO, PHI in Washington, is looking at doing these adjustments quarterly, so whatever change it is, it's going to be small one way or the other. Same thing in Maine, discontinued after 2 years due to the large deferrals. In Oregon, they achieved the goals in other ways. Florida moved to a rate cap and revenue sharing mechanisms. And Montana, because they restructured, they ended the decoupling program. This is not a new regulatory bargain. It still is the same bargain. But it's basically giving us the return of our investments and a return on that investment commensurate with the risk. It's basically getting us to the point where we are getting what the commission has authorized as the rate of return, but it is keeping it more in line so that if things happen as they do every day, we still are closer to that. It reduces utility risks without decoupling. The new rate, you have to keep filing for new rates, and when Wall Street looks at a rate case, they get a little antsy. They like to see things be a little bit more stable. With decoupling, utilities don't need to file as often if we do it right. Revenues are stabilized, risks are reduced, and basically at the end of the day, as I said, you can do it anyway. If you want to make the utilities riskier, the cost of capital goes up, consumers pay for that. If you want to make it less risky, cost of capital goes down, that's a benefit to consumers. At the end of the day, consumers pay for it one way or the other. Things to think about, and I'm running out of time, still utilities will make decisions on infrastructure based on long-term needs, and we will be making these decisions based on least cost plans. When you do decoupling, you have to think about what that will do to long-term settlements. To a certain extent, a settlement that's 5 or 10 years long and it's locked in place, or the utility will try to reduce its costs as much as it can in order to, you know, keep as much of that net revenue as they can. Decoupling sort of provides, you know, takes away that incentive. There's rate stability. How long between adjustments? You know, as we saw in some of these states, if it's too long, these deferral accounts can become large, and the pass-through can really hurt consumers. Reliability. As I said, if you're just keeping as the stock or the very basic decoupling, we're just getting that authorized return. There is no flexibility one way or the other to make needed capital expenditures between rate cases. That sort of enters into the equation. Rate design, you may want to think of rate designs as the first step or a step or complementary to doing decoupling. But is this the answer? I think it's only half the answer. What revenue decoupling does is it basically removes the disincentive to utilities to do energy efficiency, that we are not penalized for doing energy efficiency and doing things that lower our throughput. We are put back to where we would have been. But where does this go in terms of incentives to do energy efficiency and to do more than just the standard? And what we've seen in a lot of cases, in Arizona, there's annual energy efficiency performance incentives, incentive payments in a lot of states, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island. There's a shared savings on the DSM program. There's incentives over the allowed ROE for investments in energy efficiency. So there's a lot of push not only to remove the disincentives that decoupling does, but to promote and provide incentives for the utilities to get into this business and do the best job that they can. And then there are lots of revenue sharings. I really won't go into those. But the bottom line is costs are going up by hundreds of billions of dollars, and they're going up for everyone in every state, restructured or non-restructured. And usage is going up, and supply margins are getting tighter. In this region, in 2008, we could see some reliability problems. Load reduction programs can create the financial hardships, and we need to develop programs that remove these disincentives and provide the proper incentives for decoupling. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Okay, we're going to try now to, is it on? Okay, we're going to try now to patch in the California Commission. It's my understanding what they're going to do. We don't know for sure if they're going to want us to go through the PowerPoint or not, but Carrie, you'll have that ready if they do. They actually sent us two. They're going to, Gene Clinton is going to take a couple minutes at the beginning just to kind of give a broad overview of what they're doing in DSR and energy efficiency. And then there's a name I can't pronounce, Anita Tapawan Conway, who is supervisor of utility EE programs, and that person's going to share key themes and lessons learned from their EE approach. And then there's Bruce Canashiro, who's supervisor of utility demand response programs, and he's going to do the same, a similar overview of that. And then there will be someone else in the room for questions, Natalie Walsh, Branch Program Manager for EE and DR. Okay, so it's 8:30 their time. They said they should be there, so we'll give it a try. Hi, Jean. It's Karen.
Morning.
How are you doing?
Thanks.
Good. And do you have your team ready to go?
We're here at 8:30 and we all have our coffee.
Yeah, we're impressed. We're almost ready for lunch. Okay, I did already explain to the group kind of the lineup that you have planned. Did you want us to, when we get to the two specific presenters, to flip through their PowerPoints, or did you just send those so that they can be posted to the website?
They're more of background. We know that there's no way in the time that we have available we can go through those kinds of slides, although they may reference a slide or two in focusing on some key points. Do people there have hard copy of the slides, or do you have them projected?
No. We could project them.
We don't have. Do they have hard?
No, they don't, but we are posting them to our website. Actually, they're posted now, and they'll be able to download them when they go back to their offices.
So let me just, is there any reason to project?
I guess for mine, it's so. And I'll just save those slides, whatever, and cue them which one might be relevant to put up there.
Okay. So what we're thinking, Karen, is that the one file that was labeled number two, DR, demand side demand response, it would be helpful if that one were projected, and when Bruce will refer to certain slides. But it's not at all required. We don't need the efficiency one projected.
Okay. So what would be the title of the one that
I put a number two in the title.
Okay.
California 2. something.
Okay. We have it. All right. So we're just going to go ahead and let you go. Are we okay in the back of the room? Relatively okay? All right. All right. Go ahead, Jean. Thank you.
Okay. So first let me tell you who we've got on the call. I'm Jean Clifton, and I'm the Clean Energy Advisor. And we've got Natalie Walsh, who is the Program Manager overseeing efficiency and demand response. And then we have Zenaida Pawan Conway, who is the Supervisor of Energy Efficiency Programs, and Bruce Kamashiro, who is the Supervisor of the Demand Response and AMI area. Okay? So I'm just going to make a couple of remarks, and then Zenaida is going to talk on efficiency, and then Bruce on DR. And if there are questions, we'll field whatever you have for us. So I just wanted to start with putting what we're going to talk about today in context. And there are two things. One, we in California have something called an Energy Action Plan. And that is a sort of a guidance document that was first developed in 2003. Jointly by three energy agencies, and then updated 2 years ago with some additional involvement of the ISO. And that is sort of really the framing policy for California for energy resources in general. And the important thing to know about that is that there was a general agreement in something we call a loading order. And that means sort of which resources you do first versus second versus third. And in that loading order, energy efficiency comes first. Demand response and advanced metering come second. Renewables come third. And clean fossil resources and transmission comes fourth. And the expectation is that we, in theory, will try to capture all of the cost-effective resources in the first step and then go to all of the next cost-effective resources in the second step, et cetera. And in theory, you don't do any fossil until you've exhausted all your other options in any particular time frame. So that's a fundamental principle guiding how aggressive we're trying to be here on the demand side. The other important context is that some of you have probably heard that our legislature passed legislation that was signed into law on greenhouse gas reduction and global warming. And we have a state policy commitment to get to the 1990 greenhouse gas levels by 2020, and then to go beyond that in later years. And there's a very sort of robust set of activities and strategies that are targeted for how we're going to achieve that level of reduction. But the important takeaway is that energy efficiency through utility programs, building and appliance standards, and sort of efficient DG, combined heat and power, that those collectively are apt to provide about 23% or more of what we have to do to reach that greenhouse gas goal. So that's another important sort of climate action overlay on what we're doing here. So with that, I'm going to turn to Zenaida and let her share some of her thoughts and experience on the efficiencies.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so taking off from what Jean said, with the Commission's focus on energy efficiency being a resource and part of the utility's procurement portfolio, the Commission decided to basically increase substantially the funding for energy efficiency, and it's part of the procurement dollars that are now being invested by the utilities for different sorts of programs. And this all started actually, this change in focus is actually quite a contrast with what the Commission had adopted as policy before, where there is more focus on market transformation programs. But with this focus on energy efficiency as part of the procurement portfolio, there, as I've said, funding has substantially increased from the other source, which is the public goods charge. And the other major area that the commission decided to do is to set targets for energy efficiency. In 2004, the commission adopted 10-year goals for energy efficiency programs, which the four major utilities are expected to meet or exceed. And these goals are expected to be updated every 3 years. And in conjunction with that, the commission also adopted a 3-year program planning cycle for the utilities. The other major area that the commission focused on is to adopt a new administrative structure for energy efficiency programs, actually beginning in 2006. And with that change in structure, the utilities were given the role of being the administrator for the portfolio of energy efficiency programs, and also set up advisory groups to basically provide input to the utilities in coming up with their program design and program portfolio. And in addition to that, the commission also required that the utilities conduct competitive solicitation so that about 20% of the program funding will go towards third-party implementers. In addition, the commission also encouraged the utilities to basically come up with partnership programs with local government entities as part of their portfolio program. And I have a slide here, which unfortunately you guys don't have projected, but it shows the different roles of the different entities in the new administrative structure that the commission adopted. And another important aspect of that is having commission staff conduct program evaluation to determine the impact of the portfolio of energy efficiency program in terms of actual energy savings. Because with this new framework of energy efficiency as part of the resource portfolio, it becomes more imperative that the commission come up with a more independent assessment of the energy efficiency savings from the program. And another takeaway from what we've done in California is also setting up this feedback loop from the way the programs are implemented and then evaluated, and the results of the evaluation being used to basically inform the planning process and the resource planning process for the next cycle. For 2006 to 2008, as I've said, the commission has increased substantially the funding for the energy efficiency programs using procurement portfolios. So there's about $2 billion worth of funding that has been authorized, both for gas and electric energy efficiency programs for the 3-year cycle. And about $100 million or so of that will be used by commission staff to basically come up with studies to evaluate impacts of the program. Just a brief overview for 2006-2008. There's a slew of energy efficiency programs that are in the utilities portfolio. There are programs that cut across all the four utilities, and we call them site programs that cater to or target residential and non-residential customers. There's also programs that deal with on-bill and off-bill financing, new construction programs on building and appliance codes and standards and emerging technologies. And we also have a statewide marketing and outreach program that basically provides more general messages to mass market messages about energy savings and conservation. Okay. There are different types of energy efficiency programs in California. programs that offer rebate, audit, direct install, appliance turn-in, education, performance contracting program, and energy management services. And in terms of some of the, in terms of monitoring and indicators of success, right now the commission has also adopted a policy that the utility program administrator performance will be based on net resource benefits and the value of the energy savings of the program minus the cost of the program, with a minimum threshold performance tied to energy and peak savings goals. So what are some of the issues and challenges?
How much, do we have any flexibility on time? Because if not, well, we're going to need to sort of move to DR to stay within your 30-minute window.
We have a little flexibility. We can go about 10 after or so. Does that help?
Okay, maybe just in terms of some of the issues and challenges, I have a slide here that basically laid out in bullet terms the different areas where we have encountered some issues under the new administrative structure. Obviously, with the new administrative structure that has been adopted and has taken a more hands-off approach and involvement in the EE portfolio development and balancing, and it's primarily the utilities now with the help of their advisory groups that are in charge of that. There's still this whole issue about the actual roles of the advisory groups and the peer review groups in giving their input and oversight to the utilities portfolio development and balancing. And with the commission's requirement that utilities also have third-party implementers and government, local government partnership programs, there is this inherent tension as to types of programs that the utilities will be doing in-house versus the programs that are being implemented by these other entities. And there's also this tension between the timing of the program expenditures and the impacts of the programs, long-term programs such as new construction. And at this point, there is also some constraint in terms of the staff undertaking the EMNB. We've come up with contracting issues because we have to basically follow contracting rules and operate under such constraints. I would just give the floor now to Bruce to discuss the demand response program in the interest of time, and then if you have any questions, then we'll just try to answer them.
Okay.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Bruce Conashiro. I'm supervisor for the demand response and advanced metering policy area here at the commission. If we could get the presentation up, and if you could go to slide number 2. I just want to quickly touch on that just to give a little bit of a background here. As Gene said at the start, we have an energy action plan here, which is kind of our overall broad policy for energy issues, and demand response is listed in that plan as the second highest priority in our resource loading order. And within the plan, there are actually 12 action items specific to demand response, and I listed in this number 2 slide 5 of them just to give you an idea of what the marching orders, so to speak, are for the commission and for the stakeholders here that participate. Basically, advanced metering, process the utilities applications to deploy advanced metering. Dynamic pricing tariffs are important, especially as advanced metering is rolled out. Want to put customers on time differentiated rates. Education is a very key component with that in terms of educating customers about time differentiated rates and understanding how they can best participate in demand response. Measurement and evaluation, another important area in terms of verifying what are the actual demand response savings that are coming from these programs. And then, of course, integrating demand response so that into utility or load-serving entities' procurement decisions so that they're pursuing it just as strongly as they would use supply-side resources. So those are just some of the action items. Like I said, there's 12 of them, but those are some of the key ones. If you could skip to slide number 7, and there is a chart of an overview of the programs that we have in place, a little bit of a timeline. We've separated the demand response programs here into two categories, the emergency triggered programs that are triggered on a day of basis. Essentially, they're in response to an emergency situation. And then we have the newer programs, which we call economic or price responsive programs. They're triggered for the most part on a day ahead basis. The customers are notified a day before that they're being requested to reduce. And as you can see, we have a lot more of the interruptible or emergency triggered programs that have been around much longer. The commission is trying to motivate the utilities to build up their economic or day-ahead programs. And as you can see in that last column there, 2007 goal, that's the goal that the commission set as a policy for the utilities to hit by 2007, which is equivalent to about 2,500 megawatts. And as you can see, they're about halfway there. So we're trying to motivate them to increase their efforts to go out and market programs and get customers interested in them. And we can talk a little bit more about some of the issues, why there's no goal, for example, for the emergency trigger programs and why there is one for the economic ones. I can touch on that later. Moving on to slide number 8, just real quickly about advanced metering and what we have here. We have the three large utilities that are pursuing advanced metering. The first one to come through the process was PG&E, and we did approve their deployment application last summer. Maybe the important takeaway from this slide is the third bullet point, which is the type of technology they chose, which is it's actually not a solid-state interval meter, but a module that is retrofitted upon the existing mechanical meter. It does provide the functionality that we're looking for, but there are some trade-offs with respect to that choice, and I can touch on that down. If we move on to slide number 9, those are just updates on where San Diego Gas and Electric and where Southern California Edison are in the process. They've taken different approaches and strategies, advanced metering than PG&E, and again, I can touch on that in slide number 10. So if you could just quickly flip over to that one. These are just some key observations with respect to advanced metering. When we went through the PG&E case, I think there are three key factors that emerged as we evaluated the proposal that present some trade-offs, I think, that regulators would need to weigh. The issue of functionality. How much functionality is enough? What we're finding is AMI technology is continuously changing, so when do you essentially make the plunge or make the decision to say, okay, let's do it? Because in the back of your mind, you know that perhaps a year from now, technology might be already obsolete. So that's one issue. The second is reliability. PG&E chose a off-the-shelf product because it had a track record already that they could feel that comfortable with in making this big investment. But the trade-off with perhaps a product that's more reliable and off-the-shelf is probably less functionality than some of the newer technology out there. And then thirdly, of course, is the issue of cost. Want to pursue higher functionality requirements, probably will cost more. So those are the things that we grappled with the PG&E application. As I said, they chose a more modest technology, one that was more reliable, more cost-effective, and in the end, that's what the commission decided to approve. On the other hand, Southern California Edison is pursuing a much more higher functionality strategy here. And so they're actually trying to together an advanced meter, solid-state meter that has a lot more functions than PG&E's, but it's taking them more time and will probably cost more. So those are just some of the trade-offs that we're faced with here, and letting the utilities have some flexibility here in deciding which way they want to go. The key thing about the advanced metering process here, and I don't know if that's what you're setting up there in Pennsylvania, but going to the next major bullet point in number 10 is the business cases, and that's where the utilities have been directed to, when they come in with their applications, to put together a business case that demonstrates that what they've chosen is cost effective. And as you can see in some of these sub-bullet points, that PG&E was able to show that there were 90% of their costs were covered by operational savings. San Diego, on the other hand, can only demonstrate that 60% of the costs are covered by operational savings. And so there's a bit of a distinction between the utilities in terms of the starting point. And in this case, San Diego, starting from a somewhat more efficient place than PG&E's, and thus they can't gain as much operational savings as PG&E was with their investment. That's where the cards fell, but that's the process that we set up here with respect to analyzing their proposals. You can flip to the next slide, number 11, some observations about demand response. One of the key issues, policy issues here that we've been still grappling with is, should customer participation be voluntary or default? And the commission initially decided to pursue a voluntary participation policy. But as you can see from under that first bullet point, there are some drawbacks to that, one being that you have a free rider problem where the customers with the most favorable load shapes are the ones that will participate, and those that do not essentially ignore the program. Opt-in requires a lot more work on the part of the customer because essentially they can just stay where they are. You need to probably do more education and marketing. You may have to substantially increase incentives to attract participation, which leads to some cost effectiveness issues. And fourthly, you may have to change the programs and make them more attractive, which leads to some other issues that I'll touch on in the next slide. The other choice is default. Essentially, place customers on the programs for a period of time, then you give them at some point an opportunity to opt out. What we found here in California is the large industrials are heavily opposed to that. They tend to favor more the emergency trigger programs than the price responsive ones because they believe that they'll be less likely to be curtailed. For small customers, you have issues of notification and adequate education if you're placing them on a program by default. But I think what we found in some studies is that if you do a default approach, you would likely result in substantially higher participation because again, the issue of customer inertia, staying where they basically are. Let's flip to the next slide, number 12. I touched on this earlier in the previous slide, but the question is, how long do you wait before you modify program design to increase participation? So in 2003, when we started this process, the first couple years after that, customer enrollment was very modest, very small. So we're faced with the issue of, well, do we start modifying these programs to try and get more people on? But there are some issues with doing that, and one being that you create customer confusion or frustration by continuously changing the terms of the program. Some customers and some third-party entities that are part of our process of rolling these out prefer just program consistency because of the investments they make to participate. And you need some program continuity just to develop data to evaluate the programs properly. But standing pat could delay significant participation, and that may run counter to other policy objectives, push DR. So those are some of the trade-offs there about changing things or moving things quickly or trying to stay put and trying to observe what's going on. And then the last bullet point there on number 12 is just automation and technology. We're finding that that's a key part of any rollout, that if you have as part of your program rollout opportunities for customers to have access to automation, and that the automation is made affordable probably through some type of rebate, that seems to work much better in terms of getting customers to be willing to participate. Moving to slide number 13, just to wrap up, one of the other issues that we're grappling with currently here in California is measurement and accurately verifying what are the demand response savings. And what we found so far in the few years that we've had these programs is that the load reductions have been highly variable, but it's difficult to actually create a protocol that says, well, this is what the typical load reduction is for a program. And so when you have difficulties in measuring the demand response savings, you have other problems such as double procurement of supply side resources by the IOUs or our independent system operator, and it also makes cost effectiveness analysis very difficult. So that's what we're starting to do, is create a process here, trying to create a protocol here to verify what the demand response savings are, so that we can avoid the double procurement problem and the cost effect, and try to put together a cost effectiveness analysis of the program. And then lastly, one of the issues here that's definitely strong here in California is trying to align the retail programs more closely with our ISO and their operational needs in their markets. And for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen when we first started this process. So now we're basically going back to the table with them, trying to create better connection between, for example, market prices and the program incentives and the tariffs, and also trying to create better communication lines and coordination between our utilities and ISO on just timing and triggers and understanding the fairness of the resource and so on. So that's something that is definitely on our plate here in 2007 for California programs. So that kind of wraps up just some of the lessons learned with respect to demand response and AMI, and then you have there on the last slide my contact information. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. I suspect we have a ton of questions, and there might be, if we wanted to take a couple of minutes to do real basic questions, we might do that. The other option, and definitely maybe at least to supplement that, would be we have a lot of information to absorb from what you've sent and will be on the website for us to download. And I would like to encourage everyone to just look through that, maybe see if a lot of your questions are answered in those greater details. And then maybe we form a list of questions that we can send out to you and work to see if we can get those answered, you know, between now and our next meeting of this working group, and maybe even pull you in for a discussion again on some of the specific issues that you've touched on today. I think we definitely will do that if that works for you in California.
Sure.
Okay. Does anyone here, I mean, we have a few minutes, does anyone have any questions they want to ask now? Okay, I think we'll go with that approach because we are pretty sure that you've probably answered a lot of them in the more detailed slides, and we'll use that route first, and then we'll follow up with you after we have a chance to do that. Really appreciate you all getting to work early out there, and you're probably in like shorts and t-shirts, huh?
It's freezing cold here.
Oh, it's cold.
Have you heard about the California having lost 70% of its citrus crop in the last week?
Yes, I wasn't paying attention. No, I wasn't too worried about your weather.
Well, you will see if you shop at the market in the next coming week.
I guess we will. Okay.
Citrus, avocado, strawberries—they're all gone.
Darn. All right. Well, thank you very much for your participation. That information, I know, was very interesting to me, and I'm sure to everyone else in the group. And we will be in touch with you soon.
Okay. Well, good luck with the rest of your day.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Oh, turn it off. Okay, we're going to break for lunch. It looks like it's all set up out there. If you happen to be in a chair that doesn't have a table, just pull it around to somebody else. We don't really have anything formal planned over lunch. We put it as a working agenda to help with Commonwealth procurement rules, and we're expecting to have some informal discussions over the lunch. So enjoy. Thank you. Bye.